New York Times bestselling author Mark Bowden has had a prolific career as one of America's leading journalists and nonfiction writers. His new collection, The Three Battles of Wannat and Other True Stories, features the best of his long-form pieces on war, as well as notable profiles, sports reporting, essays on culture, and more, including pieces from The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, and The Philadelphia Inquirer. Mark Bowden is the author of 12 books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Black Hawk Down, as well as The Best Game Ever, Bringing the Heat, Guests of the Ayatollah, and The Finish. It's a great pleasure to welcome Mark Bowden back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Joe. My pleasure.
What is the fun and the challenge of putting a collection together?
Well, it's mostly just a pleasure because I've done the legwork and written these stories. Often when stories are published in magazines, there are accommodations to the space available in the magazine, so I have to make changes or cuts in stories. So it's a pleasure for me to be able to go back and restore these stories to the form that I preferred. And it's also nice to have a chance to offer these stories to a broader audience, because if you don't subscribe to The Atlantic or Vanity Fair or The New Yorker, you know, the chances are that you haven't seen the bulk of the work that I've done over the last decade.
The title of the book is The Three Battles of Wannat. That is also an article that is included in the collection, and I would think it probably is closest to what people know you for.
Yeah, it is because of Black Hawk Down, and I think people associate me and my work with the military, with the various war fighting that we've been doing in this country for the last 14 years, and I think that's fair. There's also, as you've noted in your introduction, quite a variety of other material, and long before I wrote Black Hawk Down, I had many years of work as a newspaper journalist, and I've covered and written about just about everything under the sun.
I want to talk about some of that in a moment. When it comes to this, as I said, the title article, The Three Battles of Wannat, this is the story of one of the bloodiest days in the war of Afghanistan, and really the fallout that it generated that went on for years. What brought you to the subject in the first place?
Initially, it was suggested to me by my editor at Vanity Fair, Cullen Murphy, who was interested in seeing a story written about this particular battle because, as you noted, it was one of the worst at that point in the Afghan war. And I initially envisioned it as an account simply of that combat. But as I looked into it further, I saw that the battle itself had initiated a long series of probes that had led initially to just about everyone in the chain of command who was involved on the American side being either reprimanded or cashiered. And then subsequently having all of those reprimands and penalties rescinded. So the story really looks at the battle itself, but then also the battle that continued to be fought within the military, within the army, to determine who, if anyone, was culpable for what was considered to have been a disaster.
When you take on something like this, where do you like to begin? Is it ultimately with the first battle, if you will?
Well, ideally, Joe, I like to begin knowing nothing, and that was the way this story went. I mean, I had seen stories in the newspaper about this fight and was aware that this bloody day had occurred, but beyond that, I knew nothing. And that's where I actually like to begin stories. I like to have a clean slate so I can go in and form my own informed impression of what actually happened. I think that's actually, if I have anything to offer, that's probably the most important thing I have to offer.
How much of this type of reporting, war reporting, did you learn in doing Black Hawk Down and becoming a part of that story?
It was a big factor for me. You know, I think almost any book that I write or any story that I work on for a long time is a process of educating myself. And so I have become better educated on the subject of the military and of warfare, the way that we fight. And so today, what is it now, almost 15, 16 years since I wrote Black Hawk Down, I've gone back to that, to war as a subject matter, in part because we as a country have been at war for some time. And I've learned a great deal about the way that the military functions and fights. And I think I have a deeper understanding of the issues that concern people in uniform.
When you started that project with Black Hawk Down, did you know it was always going to be full length and be a book?
I did. I envisioned Black Hawk Down as a book from the beginning. You know, and the reason for that was it was the first really significant combat that American forces had been involved in since Vietnam. And I had, as a journalist and as a writer, long envisioned the potential of pitched combat as material for the kind of reporting and writing that I do. So when that battle happened, I saw it as an opportunity to really plunge in and write about the phenomenon or the experience of war through the eyes of all of these men who had survived it.
When you look at something like that and take on a project, what I think was fascinating and why it struck such a chord with readers is because we didn't really know what was going on. There was so much there that we didn't know about this moment and what that fighting was like. Did you have a sense that was what you were doing too, is to really shine a light on something that so many people didn't know about, even though we were at war?
Very much so, Joe. I think one of the insights that I've gained over many years of working as a journalist is that even though we are constantly bombarded with information, in other words, we swim in a sea of information, more so than almost any people who ever lived, the pool that we're swimming in is about an inch deep. Most reporting and most of the reports that we hear are a little more than brief summaries of events that have taken place around the world that capture our interest fleetingly. And time and time again, no matter what the subject matter, if I dig in and try to understand what actually happened and why, you end up informing people of a whole lot of things that they didn't know.
In that informing, what do you look for in a piece? As we mentioned in the introduction, and as I want to talk to you about, there is such an eclectic nature to the pieces that are included in this collection. How much of it is what you're assigned? How much of it is what you're looking for and the ingredients that have to be there for you to want to spend time with a story?
I would say that it's a combination of all those things that you just mentioned. I have worked for a long time for magazines like Vanity Fair or The Atlantic with my publisher who's published all of my books. And we have a dialogue that's fairly constant where I'm suggesting things to them that interest me. They're suggesting things to me that interest them. And out of that conversation emerges the stories that I write. You know, I try, whatever the subject matter is, to arrive at an informed understanding of what exactly happened and why. And in that process, look for what I call a narrative spine. I look for the people who are at the center of the story. And I try, especially if I'm writing a long piece, to make sure that I don't lose the interest of the reader. And I think in order to do that, you have to be writing a story with a coherent structure, a story about people, a story with action, dialogue. And I think that out of that kind of storytelling, we get a far deeper understanding of the way the world works.
You seem to be also drawn to media, a subject that, of course, you're involved in, but also that you like to write about.
Well, that's true. I mean, I've spent my whole life working as a journalist, so, you know, that spans the heyday of big city journalism to, writing for pieces online, writing for magazines, and I've seen journalism evolve and go through a lot of changes, some of them good and some of them not so good. I also teach journalism at the University of Delaware, so I have, especially in recent years, kind of made a study of the history of American journalism and what's going on with my own profession in my own lifetime. I bring a lot of personal insight, and I also have some, with the teaching, have I think, deepened my scholarly understanding of how journalism has worked and works today.
There are several profiles in the book. Let me ask you about two of them. One of them being about David Simon, who you refer to as the angriest man in television. Why is he so angry?
Well, as I understand it, and I spent some time with David, and I loved his series, The Wire, which is primarily what that essay is about. And I think what I was after there was an understanding of what motivated him, what it was he was trying to accomplish in the stories that he was telling. And what I found was that he is someone motivated by anger. He is, I think, he stays angry at people. He is angry at the politics in this country. He's angry at the way our society, he feels, unjustly punishes the worthy and rewards the unworthy. And you see those themes in everything that he does. So what I tried to do in that piece was explain David Simon and his motivations in a way that would shed light on the amazing output of creative work he's done.
Are you ever motivated by anger?
I don't think so, no. I generally, as I said, begin working on stories that I know nothing about, so I'm motivated primarily by curiosity. I have written short pieces when I think it's appropriate, when I feel the need to address something in particular related to myself. And yeah, from time to time, I've written shorter pieces like that, partly because something has angered me.
But when you're writing about war, and is there an injustice that you are trying to write sometimes?
No, I'm not. I genuinely am interested in the motivations of the people I'm writing about. And I don't have an overarching personal philosophy that guides everything that I write, at least not that I'm aware of. I'm someone who feels that the purpose in writing stories is to better understand the way the world works. And if I were approaching that from the perspective of someone who thinks he has everything all figured out, I don't think I would be making as valuable a contribution to anybody else.
Mark Bowden is our guest. His new book is The Three Battles of Wannat. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. We're going to take a break and return to our conversation with Mark Bowden, talk a little bit about his thoughts on Donald Trump, which he has just written a piece about. We'll find out all about that after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Our guest is Mark Bowden. His new book is The Three Battles of Wannat and Other True Stories. Mark is the author of 12 books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Black Hawk Down. He is also the author of a new piece that appeared on VanityFair.com last month, in which he talks about his writing a profile of Donald Trump back in 1996. It was a fascinating piece. It certainly made the rounds for a lot of people as we try to figure Donald Trump out. How much time at that time did you spend trying to figure him out?
Well, I've been entertained and appalled by his emergence as a major political figure, as I think many Americans have. And because I did spend that long weekend with him some years ago, that has always informed my understanding of him. And I'd found myself in conversation with people about the political situation and about Trump, telling that story to friends and them getting such a kick out of it and gaining, I think, some of my own insight into him as a person, that I just decided that I would write it up, and Vanity Fair was interested, and as you said, it garnered a great deal of interest and attention.
One of the things that you point out in this piece is that this is something that you were doing in 1996. He had just turned 50 years old. It was a bit of a comeback, right? He was trying to mount a comeback. And while the bluster was still there, there was some wind taken out of his sails.
Oh, without a doubt. He had been driven his family business into bankruptcy. And he was, at the time that I spent the weekend with him, basically presiding over an organization that was being run by professional managers appointed by judges to right the ship. And so, I think his stature had taken a blow, but the truth is that, most people don't look that carefully at someone like Donald Trump. They just, what they see are the sound bites and the photographs and the pronouncements that he makes loudly about himself. And so I think that, he was still ringing all the bells about his own excellence and his own business acumen, even though to those who looked a little bit more carefully, they were tin bells.
You write in the Vanity Fair piece, "I was prepared to like him as I boarded his black 727 at LaGuardia for the flight to Mar-a-Lago, his Florida home, prepared to discover that his over-the-top public persona was a clever pose, that underneath was an ironic wit, an ordinary but clever guy. But no, with Trump, what you see is what you get. His behavior was cringeworthy." Well, yeah. That's what we're seeing now, isn't it?
It is, and the truth about Donald Trump is that he really believes the things he says about himself. And when, early on when he began running for president, a lot of people were speculating that he didn't really mean it, that this was just a promotional stunt. And what I felt then and would say is, no, you have to understand, Donald Trump really believes these things about himself. He believes he has this superior judgment about everything. That his everything he touches turns to gold, and he's had, I guess, enough money all of his life that he's been surrounded by people who reaffirm these notions. They don't tell him that he isn't wearing any clothes, and so he behaves like someone who has had people telling him he's right all of his life, and the whole world is getting a pretty dramatic portrait of him every day.
You also say in the piece that time after time, the stories that he told you simply didn't check out.
Yes. He makes these pronouncements because he wants to believe they're right and because they reflect well on him. And he likes to show off a broad knowledge and understanding about many things. And it turns out he really does not know all that much about a lot of things and exaggerates, everything, not just things about himself, but even, his level of understanding of simple things. He told me, for instance, that he fired his pilots because he didn't like the way they reversed the engines when the plane was landing. And in fact, that's not what pilots do. They reverse airflow, but they don't reverse engines. So his level of understanding is exposed as being, inch deep on most things. And he's a salesman. I mean, he's always selling himself. He told me that the carpeting in the bedroom at Mar-a-Lago was designed by Walt Disney, when in fact Walt Disney didn't design the carpeting. But I think he believed it when he said it.
So one of the other things, then I'll ask the ultimate question, but one of the other things you say was what was clear was how fast and far one could fall from favor. The trip from genius to idiot was a flash. And again, we're seeing that as well.
Yeah, and I pray that we don't see more and more of it. I can only imagine what a disaster he would be as president of the United States. You know, he forms these snap judgments about people and situations. He says whatever pops into his head at any given moment. I think conservatives would be appalled by the person they elected if he actually gained power, because he's just as apt to launch some major social spending program as he is to kill one. It's, you know, whichever side of the bed he wakes up on.
He was not thrilled with your story, we should note.
No, he wasn't. You know, I learned that secondhand as I wrote in the piece. His secretary told me he was too livid to speak to me, and I've not seen him since. But I think he knew and I knew that he wasn't going to like that story.
There was a thing, there was one part of your story that I think that perhaps those of us who are watching this and watching it unfold, maybe it surprised, maybe they thought it or thought perhaps it was as an indication, but you also saw flashes of anger where there was he was kicking things and at one point pretty much destroying his own tennis court. there was an internal anger there as well.
Yeah, he's a spoiled kid. He throws temper tantrums. And I think that's, you know, I'm not the only person who has seen that and written about it. You know, he is not, I don't think, a very level-headed, mature individual. And I think if you go to work for him or you're around him, you run the risk of falling rapidly from his esteem through no fault of your own.
The piece is so articulate and beautiful in coming up with basically a sketch of who this guy is. But of course it hasn't figured out the question that so many of us have of what is the attraction and what is it about this man who has become so popular in polling and everyone was expecting him to detonate at any moment is still very much a part of the contest that we are entering in just a matter of days.
Well, I think there's always been a sort of rowdy, rude, and not particularly intelligent element to our body politics. And I think that is part and parcel of democracy. You take the good with the bad with democracy. We see in Donald Trump one of the reasons why the British were so appalled by the notion in the 18th century that people should be allowed to vote, everybody should be allowed to vote, and that governments should represent the people directly. You know, back then they were burning witches at the stake, so aristocrats looked on democracy as potentially a disastrous course. And that element has always been part of our public life. Donald Trump is not the first blowhard to gain a great deal of popular attention. I think because of the existence of social media and the nature of 24/7 talk radio and cable television, that a voice like Trump's gets amplified again and again and again. And one can only hope that when people settle down and actually have to cast their vote, that they do so, most people will do so, I think, a little bit more soberly. I take heart in the fact that if you added up all of the percentages that those other Republican candidates have, that Donald Trump is losing about 70% to 30%.
Right.
So as some of these candidates drop away, I think you'll see a consolidated level of support for someone who you may or may not agree with, but is not a huckster like Donald Trump.
As you say, it is certainly is no, it's not strange to see a blowhard get media attention, as you point out. But as a good old fashioned grizzled journalist that you are, have you ever seen anything like this?
Not in my lifetime. No, I think, you know, we will look back on the last half of the 20th century and the early 21st century for all its ups and downs, had a sort of a higher level of political discourse than what we're witnessing here in the 21st century.
Well, your new collection of pieces is The Three Battles of Wannat. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Mark Bowden, it's always a pleasure to have you on our program. I thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. I enjoyed it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Mark Bowden's new book is The Three Battles of Wannat and Other True Stories. It is published by Atlantic Monthly Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.